If we examine the relationship between Lowell's art and Bruno's mnemotechnic, first we must consider if and how Bruno was a Lowellist. Indeed, their own theoretical framework are completely different, because the Christian and theological background of Lowell's system is totally absent in Bruno's perspective. Lowell settles his universe, unfolding a triadic and hierarchic transmission from God down to materiality, passing through human faculties, as the 9 degrees of the alphabet symbolize. Differently, Bruno develops a natural philosophy within an infinite cosmological horizon, absolutely detached from God, without any hierarchy inside. All beings, be they stars, planets, or human beings, are ontologically equal, made by the same matter, be alive due to a unique universal soul. Consequently, human beings are totally absorbed by the natural world, as well as their knowledge. Though hostile to any mystical and anthropocentric perspective, Bruno only faces God through the infinity of the world nature. In fact, the Eroico Furioso prefers contemplating naked Diana's inner essence, id est de substantia universalis, to Apollo's surface that theologists use to inquire by reason. This theoretical stance is partially due to a shift from a Platonic gnoseology to a hard Aristotelianism. What we know is not proper ideas, but shadows of ideas, umbre idearum, projecting truth from God, the light, through nature, the dark body, to the mind, the shadowy surface. Thus, human knowledge completely results in natural and perceptible experience. The more complex and complete it is, the more it will tend to be true. Finally, rationalism is only a part of the world intellectual process, whereas the central role is played by fantasy as a screen which connects reality with inner concepts. Every thought belongs to a particular image, and forcing Aristotle's De Anima, without images, man cannot think at all. Despite these theoretical and preliminary instances, Bruno wrote some books about Lowell's combinatory art. What is more, the presence of this peculiar technique is wider spread of all his opera. However, the works explaining Lowell's art are only 3, although he openly applies the combinatory to philosophy, mnemotechnic, methodology, or simply to rhetoric in about 10 works. Even if we can find references to the Lowellian technique in each text by Bruno. The first book commenting Lowell's combinatory is De compendiosa architettura et complemento artis Lulli, published in Paris in 1582, the same year of the Umbris Dearum et Canto Circeus, 2 books about mnemonics. The De compendiosa architettura is a short commentary of the Ars Brevis, and it was printed by Gilles Gorben, the same printer of the De Umbris Dearum, and many other Lullian works, among which, in 1578, Ars Brevis itself, as reprinted from the 1514 edition by Bernard de la Vigneta. Those years, Bruno was privately teaching theology and philosophy at Collège de Paris. Nevertheless, he became famous as mnemonic and Lully's master. Thanks to these 2 peculiar interests, he managed to meet the French King Henry III, and then he was accepted at the Collège Royal. The second Lullian work is the Lampade Combinatoria Lulliana, a longer Ars Brevis commentary with a more substantial rhetoric outcome, printed in 1587 at the apex of Bruno's very short academic career, after he had spent 2 years teaching dialectic as professor at Wittenberg University. There, he gathered a large number of students, and many of them became his devoted followers. Bruno was trying to convert them to his natural philosophy, well outlined in his last 3 years' English stay, Trout Lullis and Mnemonic. Finally, the third book, entitled De Specerum Scutino et Lampade Combinatoriae Raimundi Lulli, was edited in Prague in 1588. It is a simple collection of the previous two, assembled by Bruno to introduce himself to the Spanish ambassador at the imperial court. In fact, Guillaume de San Clemente was the most influential politician in Rudolf II's entourage. And just like the emperor, he was an occultist and, moreover, one of Lull's fanatic admirers, even boasting to be his descendant. As we have just seen, all Bruno's Lullian works originated within a Lullistic cultural frame. During the whole 16th century, France was an important area for Lullistic studies, especially after Lefebvre de Tappe had called Bernard de la Vigneta to teach Lullians in Paris. Similarly, in the Wittenberg University, there was a marked trend to look for alternatives to Ramists, i.e. Calvinists. So Lull's technique was there well known up to the end of the century. Even more, in the very next years, the so-called Philip Ramist movement would have spread across the whole Germany, using Lullism as a mean for blending Ramist method and Philip Melanchthon's dialectic. In a similar atmosphere, Rudolf II's occultist interest found in Lull's method an unrealistic way of merging admitted doctrines with forbidden ones. In all these circumstances, the Lullism they used was not the original Lullian system. On the contrary, they were adopting a dialectic and encyclopedic tool grounded on a version of Lull's combinatory which had been totally or almost totally deprived of his own theology and philosophy. We must consider Bruno's other works referring to combinatory inside this peculiar cultural atmosphere, although they are about mnemonics, dialectics, or philosophy. The first two of them, the Umbris Dearum and the Cantus Circeus, are edited in Paris in the same year of De Compendiosa Architettura. The Explicatio Trigintas Cellorum was to be published in the next year in London. However, it exposed materials Bruno had developed in the near past. They all included handbooks about an art of memory, which applied the combinatorial technique to several elements. From the combining wheels used to shape images for syllables or words, to the building of visual architecture, arranging orders and levels of mnemonic data. The Lampade Venatoriae Logicorum, Wittenberg for 1587, and the Lampa Sterginta Statuarum, first written in 1587 and then edited only at the end of 19th century in a volume about Bruno's magic works, were part together with the Lampade Combinatoria Lulliana of an editorial project concerning dialectic and philosophy, a sort of overall encyclopedia, as Michele Ciliberto described the Lampas, about the Nolana Philosophia. Finally, last Lullian works such as the De Imaginum Compositione, the De Artificium Perorandi, or De Medicina Lulliana are all written and partially edited during the German period, when Bruno was moving from Wittenberg to Frankfurt, then to Helmstedt and Zurich. Specifically, the De Artificium Perorandi collects some lessons about rhetoric, exposed according to a combinatorial structure, which Bruno taught in Zurich and edited post-mortem, whereas the Medicina Lulliana must be ascribed to Helmstedt's years, when Bruno used a Lullistic code in order to attract his students through hermetic, magic and dialectic interests. I told French and German Renaissance Lully was not proper close to the original Lullian system. Rather, it was a dialectic and methodological reinterpretation of its combinatory. Likewise, Bruno's Lullism was too. Anyway, from which text did it derive it? Critics showed how Bruno formerly had met Lull's works in Napoli during his youth. Probably at that time, he was reading the Arbor Scientiae, and later in France, he might have learned the combinatory technique, reading the Ars Magna and the Ars Brevis. His contacts with French Lullists, or even more, with Gilles Urbain, the editor of many Lullian works, might have made Bruno know Bernard della Vigneta, Esplanatio Compendiosaque Afflicatio Artis Raimundi Lulli, the most systematic and the largest Renaissance compendium of Lull's philosophy and art. Gilles Urbain was also the editor of both the Ars Brevis and the De Aditu Cabalistico, as well as Bruno's De Umbris Dearum and De Compendiosa Architettura. In Paris, he also might have read a manuscript version of Logica Nova and the 1515 printed in Rhetoricam Isagoge, an apocryphal summa of Lullism, and furthermore, another famous Renaissance handbook of Lullist dialectic. Bruno Weidel refers to both texts in many of his works. Lastly, in order to further describe the relationship between Bruno's Lullism and its cultural milieu and the cogent size of this framework, it is useful to mention the 1598 Strasbourg Zetzner edition of Raimundi Lulli opera, which included the Specerum Scutinium and the Lampade Combinatoria Lulliana, as well as the Lampade Venatoria Logicorum. They were part of the commentary section, together with Agrippa's commentaries, while the main section contained Ars Brevis, Ars Generalis Ultima, De Auditu Cabalistico, In Rhetorica Misagoge, and Logica Brevis et Nova. The latter had been previously included in La Vigneta's Esplanatio. Giordano Bruno's interest in Lull's combinatory was primarily dialectical. Furthermore, he had found in that technique the right features he could have well applied to own philosophical perspective: a coherent structure and a productive dynamism, just as his idea of nature had. Indeed, Bruno's natural universe is an endless organism. It is a huge, complex, and non-stop transforming structure of living beings, which includes stars and planets and all the living creatures inhabiting them. It has no ontological hierarchy. It has no center, no bounds. Nevertheless, it has two simple laws as a resulting of the union of two theoretical principles, de vicissitudo universalis and causanus coincidentia oppositorum. The first law decrees that everything is continuously changing. The second one, which Bruno simply declines with the natural horizon, establishes that every change is the passage from a state to its opposite through a progression of similar degrees. The specular theoretical foundations demand a consequent gnoseological perspective, a proper dialectic and a consistent logic. According to Bruno, everything is subordinated to nature, knowledge included. We will see later how each act of creation, be natural or human as well, derives from nature, and how also thinking can be considered as an inner creation. Anyway, let us focus on what Bruno is finding out from Lull's combinatory and how it should be applied to his dialectic. He deduced from it structure and dynamism, managing alphabets, tree, scalae, tabulae, and above all, combinatory wheels. He forcefully inserts them into the main operation of Renaissance rhetoric dialectic, the dispositio and the inventio, likewise many other Renaissance lullists had done. This actually means that Bruno, on a first level, applies combinatory to every argumentation. He uses its raw sequences, scheme, and combinations, although with no reference to their theoretical background, in order to compose, arrange, and transform words and arguments. His ultimate dialectical goal is generating the meaning itself, modeling linguistic objects as if they were part of the living natural matter, since he considers intellectual creativity like the expression of the universal soul embodied into all creatures. At the second step, he applies the combinatory to mnemonics. Fantastic images are strictly part of knowledge, because they are the fundamental and the only medium between sensory experience and conceptual abstraction. Each sensory datum is translated into a proper image, as well as each conceptual achievement needs a peculiar old image, a fantastic body, to be related with others' data and concepts. Thinking cannot be possible without images. Even more, we concretely think by the means of images. Consequently, the ancient art of managing images, the ars memoriae, results being the privileged tool of a new dialectic, the most fitting one with both human experience and natural action, a kind of visual rational irrational activity that Paolo Rossi defined as a fantastic logic, logica fantastica. Let me now show you some examples of this peculiar way to use Lull's combinatory, first focusing on inventio and dispositio of terms and arguments, then analyzing how and why the same dialectic attitude should be transferred to mnemonic images and plays. The first example, so you can go to the sixth slide, the sixth number slide at the end of the test. The first example comes from Explicatio Treginta Sigillorum, a work published in London in 1583. It is a book about the art of memory, with an important third section about knowledge and dialectic, which is entitled Sigillus Sigillorum. Differently, the two main sections present and explain 30 seals. It has symbolic and concise teachings for the invention, disposition, and memory of any discipline and art, as the frontispiece declaims. The fourth sigillum is the tree, and it shows a strict hierarchy scheme consisting of subordinated sequences originating from a mind one. Its formal structure is well described by the picture Bruno added to the text, which is openly inspired to Lullian diagrams and suggestively has got the shape of a tree made by the letters of the alphabet. You can see at this one. The first one, this one. It can be used for inventio and dispositio of terms, even if it also works to arrange mnemonics images, either inspiring their pattern or building a simple architecture hosting them. Anyway, let us raise what Bruno specifically designates for the inventio terminorum. When we want to speak about any subject, we must manage it as if we were watching a tree. First, we have to consider its roots. It has the principle of its origin, as well as the causes of the foundation. Then the trunk, it has its own essence. Thirdly, the branches, it has potentialities, abilities, and possibilities. Then the leaves, that are the accidents and the circumstances. Additionally, the flowers, and its action and operation. Lastly, the fruits, which are the acts and their outcomes. As we can see, this doesn't properly deal with the inventio terminorum, rather with their arrangement, their dispositio, like in the traditional rhetoric of logic it was. Nevertheless, Bruno considers this way of arranging terms as an inventio because it develops a kind of process and procedure generating terms, thus it creates the meaning. As a matter of fact, he is referring to a more dynamic notion of inventio, closer to an idea of the natural fecunditas as the outcome of a living universal structure rather than a dialectical one. However, this peculiar feature is explicitly ascribed to Lull's technique, as Bruno declares at the beginning of the fourth sigillus explicatio. The tree supports the invention and the judgment just like it is shown in the book of Arbor Scientiae. Bruno renews this commitment with Lull's famous work also in the Imaginum Compositione, but there he advances an important methodological remark. Our tree differs from Lull's tree because it is solid, while his is flat, just as pyramid differs from a triangle, as a solid body from a surface. For that reason, it offers a way of invention through eight and wheel, but our drives a path through the multiplex profound. Bruno is comparing a two-dimensional tree with a three-dimensional one. That actually means a one-directional or a flat argumentative pattern versus a more effective branched scheme, a multi-directional path for generating meanings. Furthermore, in the Imaginum Compositione, Bruno wants to show his deep betrayal of Lull's system, not only by strengthening the outcomes of Lull's combinatory tools, but once again highlighting his own dialectical and philosophical originality. Consequently, he stresses his radical distance from Lull's theoretical background. Finally, he also mentions his a new idea of combinatory applied to mnemonics that was totally ignored by Lull himself. Yes, his is the father of ours, while ours is the child, so far as pertains to the work of a formal invention. However, concerning the subject of sciences that are certainly speculative, it is not Lull that we consult. Moreover, for what pertains to some other intellectual powers of the soul, it has fantasy, our tree is totally of another genus, about which Lull appears not even to have doubt. The second example about dialectics directly deals with dispositio terminorum. It also comes from explicatio triginta sigillorum, and it peculiarly refers to the item seal. It is entitled De Quadrato Encyclio, it has a squared encyclopedia, where squared means fourfold, as the number of parts and subparts a subject can be divided into. As a matter of fact, it offers a way of arranging concept with a four-based scheme. Thus, you can realize a squared encyclopedia when four concepts, intentiones, are set upon a main subject, then other four concepts are set above each one of those four, which are put below as their subjects. Furthermore, each one of the last four is put below other four subsequent concepts, and you could go on this way until both your needs and the necessity of what has to be arranged will allow it. This peculiar paradigm that has got a twin seal named De Binari Encyclio is specifically dedicated to the dispositio of arguments. It works as a regular and recursive four-parted structure of several subordinated layers, which spring up from the first subject. It has the main topic to be analyzed. It is such a kind of inverted three-dimensional dialectic pyramid, because its vertex is settled underneath. By the way, this is confirmed by Bruno himself, who openly mentions the solid shape of this seal too. Once again, in the Imaginum Compositione, Bruno states that both the binarium and the quadratum enciclium have to be placed under the shadow of our tree, it has the tree seal, which actually means that both these two sigilli, technically and theoretically, are grounded in the Lullistic framework established at the background of his dialectic. It may be a problem that, according to Bruno, dialectical inventio and dispositio seem to be quite similar. In fact, they offer a structured arrangement of terms, but the difference between them is the dynamics. The inventio moves the terms and generates their meaning along a pattern. The dispositio confirms to them that pattern. Anyway, both inventio and dispositio are devices for deploying and composing terms, arguments and concepts as well, indeed a combinatory. I have shown how Bruno tries to transfer Lull's technique into the traditional dialectic. The specular shift is due to a different view of dialectic itself, considering every term as an atomistic object into a structured system of neutral logical relationships, like a point within the geometrical space. This deeply matches with the Renaissance idea of dialectic, which sharply distances itself from the deterministic logic of late scholastic, which was totally absorbed by the quantitative analysis of terms inside the syllogistic structure. Otherwise, Renaissance authors such as Lorenzo Valla, Rudolf Agricola, or Pierre de La Rame had contributed to reform dialectic within a completely renewed ideological framework in which rhetoric and dialectic were converging. Furthermore, dispositio or topica became the new and main model to compose a discourse or a text, while inventio was considered synonymous with fecunditas and creativity, rather than the search for the right medium term. This is the same theoretical horizon in which Bruno settles his dialectic too. In addition, he emphasized even more the value of both disposition and invention by means of combinatory. In fact, he manages the terms as if they were the pieces of a whole dialectic linguistic machinery, whereby the equivalence between the letters of the Lullian alphabet and the fundamental parts of the words would seem to be more than a symbolic formalism. Moreover, this is why every seal can systematically be adaptable for either the dispositio of term or their inventio, as well as for either arranging or shaping mnemonic images, so as every element of whatever expression can be considered as an atom or a point within a net of relationship. Similarly, every syntactic relationship can be expressed as a dynamic composition of terms, like the aggregation of atoms forming a body, or the mark of the line connecting points into a figure. By the way, this theoretical parallelism among dialectic, atomism and geometry will find a formal definition in Bruno's late philosophy, when he theorizes the minimum. Despite the difference between words and images, their grammar and their syntax, Bruno works out to manage words and images with the same combinatorial tools, because he has successfully translated the dialectic into a visual activity. So dispositio becomes an architecture of places, and inventio a movement throughout them. Subjects can be considered as characters, predicates as the action they make. We first examine how this positio can be transformed in a visual architecture, reading an important excerpt from Cantus Circeus, Bruno's second mnemotechnic work. Actually, this subject, because it results peculiarly able to receive memorable forms, so as they should be memorized, it can be the most general, it is so vast as the space of the whole universe is, or quite general, it is just as the extent of geography, or general, like the extension of a continent. Furthermore, it can be particular within a political dimension, or even more particular, having a domestic or economic extension. Lastly, the most particular, just like the very many parts of a house and its smallest ones. This passage is quite ambiguous, and I must confess that many commentators didn't understand it at all. One of them, for example, once stated that it refers to the subject of the discourse, which it could be about astronomy, geography, politics, business, or architecture. Of course, I cannot deny that those literary all are, according to the degrees of this sequence. But what does Bruno really mean with subject? He has explained it a page before. In this book, I don't assume the subject just like physics or logic assume it, but in the way this technique conventionally requires, according to its artificial meaning. In other words, it is the subject of fantastic forms that can be freely placed, removed, or moved around by operating fantasy and cogitativa. Therefore, Bruno is intending the mnemonic subject just like the locum where mnemonic images are to be placed into. Consequently, he is describing how large a mnemonic place should be and, above all, how mnemonic places should be arranged in order to better host all the mnemonic data. The largest place embraces the largest quantity of images, as the smallest place, propissimum, will host only a single image. This means that there is a decisive structural connection between the physical visual extent of loci and the logical extension of mnemonic data. As general the information is, so large the plus must be. On the contrary, a single datum needs only one image. Thus, it will be placed in a single and small locum. Practically, if I want to memorize a book parted in three sections, each one divided in five chapters formed by tens of paragraphs, I shall contemplate in my fantasy a three-floor palace, where each floor will host five large rooms, in which I will find out tens of small and peculiar places, such as corners, windows, recesses. Then I will be able to put inside them, in the right order they originally had, all the images of what I need to memorize. Bruno identifies this architectural and creative process with a combinatorial approach to mnemonics. The more the architecture is well formed, the more the logic and the dialectic system of the data will be preserved. We can see how this idea can be visually symbolized watching the picture on the right side, the eighth slide. A man with his arms open, a kind of Vitruvian paradigm assumed in classical mnemonics, is placed in the middle of a square next to a well, U letter. All around at the corners there are other smaller pictures, the celestial globe, the earth, a circle quadrant, a square. They depict the different forms of general places. The most general, it has the astronomic sphere, like Metrodorus of Sepsis had taught, linking memories to the 48 constellation. The more general, that is the Earth, it has the geographical or political place. Then the domestic or economic place, that is as large as a house is. It is described by a quadrant, because this is the symbol Bruno uses for the atrium, that is an unique and large hall parted into several smaller rooms, named cubilia or officine. Further, we have the cubilium. It has the single room that can host up to 9 single places, the 4 corners plus other 5 recesses, if we consider the middle of each wall and the center of the room itself. Lastly, there is the particular place, that is where the single image has to be placed. Usually, this one is a whole complex scene with a living character doing something within this peculiar frame. Later, I will examine how and why this peculiar idea about mnemonic places represents an innovation in managing mnemonic structures. Once again, I would like to highlight that such a strict disposition of places means, for Bruno, the best translation of dialectical disposition into a visual one. Let us now consider a second example, in which the combinatorial perspective is even more relevant than the previous one. It belongs to Ars Memoriae, the large mnemonic section completing the De Umbris Dearum, and specifically deals with Memoria Verborum. The traditional mnemonics had always considered either Memoria Rerum, memorization of things, or Memoria Verborum, memorization of words, as distinct issues. The first had been used to translate the meaning of a theme into equivalent image. The second one worked to shape the sound of a word, because it presumed its meaning unknown. Mnemonists used to arrange a sort of visual alphabet, in which figures would recall the shape of the letters. Sometimes they used to employ either living characters, it has Albericus, Bernardo, Caesar, or animals, avis, bos, canis, whose initials represented the letters. In order to form a word image, they simply composed all the letter images as a unique scene, making the single images to connect themselves by some peculiar actions. Some more complex word memory devices could contemplate the possibility of creating a visual alphabet of syllables, then directly compose them. As a matter of fact, the more complex the alphabet was, the more simple the image resulted. On the contrary, too many letter images would have produced a too much rich scene, especially if the word was long. A good compromise might have been a medium-rich alphabet and a well-versatile composing tool, just like some mnemonists such as Publicius, Romberg and Bruno did. All of them will choose to employ combinatory as a means of managing letter-syllable images and thus forming the right-fitting word scene. In spite of the fact that Bruno's idea is not absolutely original, the way he applies the Lullian combinatory to Memoria Verborum into the Umbris Idearum is quite innovative. He creates a more and more complex machinery of combinatorial wheels, offering to readers a gradual set of tools for learning how to dynamically manage the images. Thus, it starts with a first exercise made by 30 images alphabet and 2 wheels. Then he considered three wheels in order to compose a three-letter syllable image. Finally, he suggests a 150-syllabic alphabet, 30 letters for 5 vowels, moved by 5 combinatorial wheels, in order to form a scene for up to 5 syllable words. Let us examine how the first level works. We have to imagine 30 living characters for the same number of letters. This is because Bruno is considering all the letters of the Latin alphabet, plus 4 letters from Greek and 3 from Hebraic. Indeed, none of these 7 added sounds exist in Latin or Romanic languages, and Memoria Verborum is peculiarly useful with foreign words. In order to compose a two-letter syllables image, we need a second alphabet. Thus, the fourth step consists in creating another 30 images series. This time, the wheel represents action to be connected to the former 30 living characters. Bruno suggests a list drawn from Ovid's Metamorphoses. Lycas is laying at a banquet. Deucalion is throwing stones. Apollo is killing the python. Argus is grazing his calves, and so on. The order of images in Ovid's text suggests both the sequence and value of letters they represent. Finally, the two groups have to be moved, as if they were on two combinatorial wheels. Firstly, you must impress in your memory those wheels previously presented, so as they were still, until you have clear which action must be assigned to each one character. Then you shall train with this further and more important exercise, aimed at obtaining a first composition that consists of two any letters. In fact, you could see that the first picture was made by two steel wheels. Now, while keeping the external one steel, you will release the internal wheel. Anyway, this one was formerly steel, because its condition and purpose should be stillness. Now, on the contrary, in order to make it work, it needs to turn all around, having to be very versatile, if we want it to produce many and several operations. Bruno is describing the passage from the two steel alphabets to their composition, in order to shape a syllable. He says that by moving the internal wheel, all its 30 letters may be associated to each one of the 30 letters of the external wheel. This also happens in Lull's combinatory. Therefore, what Bruno means about mnemonics may be, as some critics misunderstood, do we really need to imagine those wheels twisting in our mind? What actually Bruno is teaching is how to apply a combinatorial principle to a mnemonic and visual scenery. Thus, we must first memorize the two steel alphabets. It has 30 characters with their own actions, as if they were a single visual system. Then, after considering both characters and action as two different series, we must mix up all action and characters. Therefore, the rotating wheels are only a symbol, even a graphic symbol, since Bruno drew them inside his book, of a combinatorial dynamic process. Thus, you must combine all the action with all the characters in order to form the scenes of all the possible couples from two 30 letters alphabet. For instance, if Lycas, instead of laying at his banquet, is throwing stones, as Deucalion does, it will signify AB. Then the 2, 3, and 5 wheels of Ars Memoriae are simply combinatorial formulas, which have to be applied to images. Once again, the ordering, movements, and mutations must express on a visual level the semantic and logical relationships their meanings have. Let's us back to Sigilli in order to discover the ultimate version of Bruno's fantastic combinatory. I will draw my last example from the 21st seal, which is entitled De Rota Figoli, that is, the potter's wheel. Bruno uses this metaphor to symbolize the operation of combining images together with their ordering and their modeling, as Bruno seems to suggest at the very starting lines of the Sigillus Explicatio. The atrium, which is the place, is alike the wheel. Those who figure are alike the potter. The meaning that has to be figured is the clay. Bruno's description could not be more explicit. The system of Loci itself is the combinatorial tool, because the mnemonist can shape and modify the images into and throughout them. In fact, they who manage places and images may impose on them any hierarchy and dynamic, first by making horizontal movements towards places, then displaying by images the vertical passage from higher levels to subordinated ones, mixing up both sequences and orders. Nevertheless, it is in the second section where we can read a very curious but enlightening application. If you want to practice with mathematics, it is astronomy and astrology, by means of this technique, as if you would like to retain the aspects of the stars, their meanings, and the meaning of planets' position within the scenes, you shall arrange 12 domos, figured with their supplementary objects. They should include so many elements and parts to be extremely convenient in making any examination through and into them. Furthermore, you shall also arrange 7 subjects, which will turn all around, and due to the many affection they receive into the places, you could methodically signify everything the planets express. This astrological implementation of the Rota Figuri is very helpful to make us understand how the fantastic combinatory should really work. First, the mnemonist have to arrange the Loci system. It has 12 domos. They are small rooms with many objects and several recesses inside. They are all ordered in a circular sequence, just like if they were a gallery or a cloister. In fact, they must symbolize the zodiac scenes, or better, the 2 elf astrological houses in which the horoscope's charts is parted, as we can see in the picture. Thus, with the first operation, Bruno sets up the base structure of his inner modeling, the wheel, as he said by his metaphor. It is a semantic closed pattern with a big kit of virtual accessories useful to form many scenes. The second step consists in combining the 7 active images with objects assigned to the houses by making them wander and operate through the mnemonic places so that they could form many scenes. In this case, the images of the 7 living characters will personify the planets, a very old and slow man for Saturn, a thunder-stricken Jupiter, a brilliant Sun, Mars the warrior, a young and sexy Venus, the flying Mercury, lastly the pale and cold Moon. This suggestive crew, together with all the objects and places, are the clay, the raw matter the mnemonist has to model in order to shape out all the possible meanings it could generate by the mutual combining of its many visual elements. Likewise, the formerly mixing up of characters and action produced all the syllables. Finally, we are able to see how the potter's works can form all the astrological meanings and schemes. In fact, by moving a planet image into a scene I could represent its value. Secondly, I will be able to show its relationship with other planets, place it into their own sin houses, by making both of them interact. Otherwise, I could express the most general level of their meaning by referring all of them to the whole sin system. Once again, Giordano Bruno is so skillful in mixing up different theoretical layers and languages in order to put forward his philosophical view. He is using the astrology, even though it does not really support the Ptolemaic cosmology, because the geocentric perspective is the same of the fantastic one, which implies an inner eye placed at the center of a sphere of moving, changing images. While Bruno is building his fantastic world, equally he tried to describe his idea of nature. Indeed, his recurring and recursive mnemonic operation symbolically disclosed to us the shadow of nature's vicissitudo. It is now the time to escape from the oneric world of mnemonics and try to sum up what combinatory definitively means. It is clear to all of us, I hope, that Lull's combinatory has no theoretical value within Giordano Bruno's philosophy. Rather, it is a plain technical tool. He uses it to dynamically and creatively manage terms, arguments, and mnemonic images as well. He simply considers Lull's figure, such as scalae, tabulae, and rote, as graphic formulas of combinatorial operations. He applies them, likewise other dialecticians and mnemonists did, to the language, with the peculiarity that he believes the fantasy be wholly part of the semantic and linguistic sphere. However, this premise does not prevent the fact that Bruno confers a strong theoretical value to his use of combinatory, and above all, that the outcomes of the impact of Lull's combinatory on Bruno, on Bruno's dialectic and mnemonics are many. Thus, let us focus again on the relationship between the architecture of place and the logical structure of retained data. This feature is fundamental for Renaissance mnemonics, even more according to Bruno's perspective, since he considered it the main innovation he found out. Then, it is not without reason if, just right at the beginning of the Ars Memoria, Bruno explains these problematic issues about recollecting memories. This weakness happens because of the lack of connection. For this reason, the users of the art often cannot retrieve images placed there. Nevertheless, it seemed that our forerunners did not understand the cause of that. Thus, Bruno immediately reveals the core point. On the contrary, since we have found out and solved it, we don't need to use physical places it experienced throughout external sense anymore, nor we confine the order of memories within the order of places. But thanks to the pure architect of our fantasy, we will be able to connect the order of places to the order of things we have to memorize. Bruno has just pointed out what mnemonists traditionally did. They first visualized a system of place, then they put images inside them. They did not think of places as specifically ordered for those images. Rather, they were simply choosing a location that was usual for them, such as a cathedral or a palace they well knew. It was the familiarity with this place to assure its own memory. However, all the lodge inside, it had nothing to do with order or images placed into them. They only represented a raw sequences of position. Therefore, he is suggesting to radically change this paradigm. If we want all the images to be a whole and true mnemonic scene, then we must model images and places as well in order to have both of them in accordance with the whole mnemonic data. Indeed, like each image has to represent a specific datum, similarly the system of places must represent the system of data. In other words, their logical structure has to be translated into the structure of loci. This is why a Brunian mnemonist needs to use the Lullian combinatory. It can confer order to places and images better than any other dialectical or mnemonical tool could do. Combinatory has got its formulas. It has strong rules for composing and combining things. It has structure and dynamism, as we said. After passing to analyze the theoretical outcomes of Bruno Combinatory, it is useful to rapidly read how it really intends logical structure, since they must reflect nature. They cannot have any hierarchy. Consequently, they have to form a whole systematic net of logical and semantic relationship, just like a living body, or even better, the whole universal giving body. Indeed, this parallelism between the world of the logic and the natural world is so strict that it really is the fundamental and theoretical core of Bruno's own dialectic. You can reach our goal when you are able to move from a confused plurality to a clear unity. Indeed, this doesn't mean to blow up logical universalia. Actually, they are collected from the inferior species, even though they are distinct, through the confused middle ones, up to the highest and even more confused species. Rather, it does mean to arrange a whole unity, as if we were collecting many and shapeless parts altogether. A hand is connected to the arm, a foot to the ankle, and an eye to the forehead. In fact, they result more cognizable when they are composed rather than divided. Therefore, as no parts and species of universe are isolated and excluded from one order, which is, when related to the first intellect, the most perfect, simple, and beyond any number, if we think of our concepts by connecting them to one another and collecting each of them rationally, what may not we understand, remind, and realize? Let me still take your time up for a few minutes, trying to draw some philosophical conclusions. We have shown how, in Bruno's philosophy, the inner thought can be considered as mixing up of both rationality and irrationality. Indeed, thinking through images actually means pursuing concepts and intuitions into a three-dimensional sphere, a virtual microcosm, where the past and the present, the outside and the inside reality, are connected through fantastic visions. Moreover, thinking without images is absolutely impossible, because all the thoughts, even the most abstract, are necessarily related to perceptive experiences. No idea is connected with the metaphysical truth. They are all shadows of ideas, because they always need reality to be set up. Therefore, only images mediate between things and concepts. Moreover, we need them for managing intellectual contexts too. As we read before, logical universalia are confusing because they are empty containers unrelated to reality. On the contrary, ideas must be considered as classes. It has sets of either subordinate sets of all members. In fact, the most general a concept is, the widest is the net of references it has with other correlated concepts. Thus, every thought is conceived by Bruno as a versatile intellectual object within an open net made by all possible conceptual relationships. Specifically, every general idea is an aggregate of similar mental representation, which in turn are derived from experience. A concept is never closed. Rather, it is constantly adjustable, depending on the quantity and quality of its conceptual relationship with both concepts and experiences. Because of this theoretical core, Bruno prefers Lull's combinatory to traditional logic, since it allows to manage concepts as geometrical points and generate arguments as if they were geometrical figures within the linguistic space. In other words, the logical linguistic world must be engaged within a structured framework. Every point of this framework has to be connected to the others. We need dynamic logical formulas to move inside this framework and generate meanings. By the way, these are the same theoretical conditions Pierre Delarame assigned to his three Aure Regole on method. Let us now focus on a further feature deriving from Bruno's gnosological background. Thinking through images presume forming fantastic representation in a two-directional way. First, when we receive perception. Secondly, when we use concepts. In both cases, either abstracting or reflecting, we shape contexts, either species or intentiones, into fantastic images. Thus, concepts have got a bodily form. They impress fantasy, just like forms within matter, while an undefined intellectual and conscious subject, the whole personal soul, is playing the role of creator. As a matter of fact, Bruno considers thinking as an act of creation, so that let us analyze the proportion it settles up among human creativity, nature and metaphysics. In this book, Id est de imaginum compositione, we are proposing a method which doesn't concern things, rather the signs of things. However, it is a method which contains, beyond any doubt, the productive power of all the things to be done. That could be easily understood by those who contemplate, even superficially, nature itself, together with its voice that always resounds around us, and its characters too, by which it draws the species of things, because it seemed to be the idea, id est the form, more than the matter, that contributes to the specification of things to be produced. Thus, in this principle, all things come together and are one. And actually, in this one and through this one, all things are distributed into the genus, the species, and their numbers. The art of memory, as Bruno says, is a method. That means a disciplined technique. However, it pushes its roots down to the first natural principle, the productive power of things to be done. This one is not the matter, rather it is the form. It has the universal soul, because it contains all the forms of all possible things and it transmits them to the matter. Therefore, as we have to consider the matter as the fantasy itself, similarly we find out that the inner creativity, the action of the inventive memorative faculty, corresponds to the universal creativity. Thus, the ultimate goal is to understand that our imagination can be held like the universal form inside the natural matter, producing every mnemonic sign from any system of images, mixing up symbols and so generating new meanings. The strong parallelism between human inventiveness and natural creation is also described at the beginning of Ars Memoriae, when Bruno investigates about the relationship between art and nature, subverting the Aristotelian paradigm. In fact, it is not the nature to be an artifex, rather, all artifices are natural, human beings included. I ask, where does this faculty of creating come to the art from? With no doubt, from where the intelligence resides. But whom the intelligence belongs to? To human beings. Finally, where do originally human beings, together with all their faculties, derive from? Indeed, from nature, which generates everything. Therefore, if you want to examine it from the beginning, picking up that plant from its roots, bow yourself with reverence to nature's knowledge. You will certainly and successfully obtain it if you pay close attention to the principle that resounds and shouts out from the inner of us, enlightening our soul. The focus is, one again, on the principium which resounds and shouts out to the surface of reality from its very inner depth. It constitutes the active and creative power of the unique universal substance, id est the anima mundi, while its passive counterpart is absolute matter. Bruno is aiming to demonstrate that if we consider human intelligence as an active and creative power, it necessarily should belong to the substantial active and creative power of human nature, that is, nature itself. This is a very dangerous ground. Critics often noted how these pages, as well as the similar others of De la Causa, Spaccio della Bestia Trionfante, or Cabala del Cavallo Pegaseo, could mark the nearest point to Renaissance Averroism. As a matter of fact, Bruno is asserting that human intellectual creativity is part of a universal one. So he is presuming such a kind of universal intellect or something alike. What is more, in De la Causa, he just considered how the active part of universal substance could be a sort of intelligence. The universal intellect is the innermost, most real, and most proper faculty or potential part of the world soul. It is that one and the same thing that fills everything, illuminates the universe, and directs nature to produce her various species suitably. It is to the production of natural things what our intellect is to the production of the representation of things. The Pythagoreans call it the mover and agitator of the universe. The Platonists call it world artificer. The Hermetists says that it is the most fecund seeds, or yet that is the seed sower. Orpheus call it the eye of the world. Empedocles call it the differentiator. Plotinus says it is the father and progenitor. Therefore, the universal intellect plays the role of an active creator, and it has been defined as a faculty of the world soul. However, since it is a part of anima mundi, then it cannot be separated from the world natural substance, which the world soul belongs to. Actually, the universal intellect can be considered as an attribute of nature itself, the ontological faculty of its productive action. Furthermore, Bruno is describing how it works throughout a metaphor that, at this point, is well known to us. The universal intellect makes things just as our intellect forms species rationales, id est concepts. Lastly, even though Bruno has recalled all the traditional definition of universal intellect, he finally asserts the radical originality of his own position. As for us, we call it the internal artificer, because it shapes matter, forming it from inside. We can see now how this excerpt I quoted can definitively clarify the conclusion of the passage we had previously read. Thus, since nature produces everything possible, either before natural things or within and throughout them, then you must understand that any action can derive from any natural things, in order to find out that nature first is acting throughout them. Bruno's Ardo syllogism is eventually concluded. When we think, we create. Since we are creating, we are artifices. Anyway, as nature is the first and the only artifex, thus nature itself creates throughout us. We are going to close showing how mnemonic art might give us the immediate experience of this fundamental theoretic statement. Our last passage still focuses on this important connection between the intellectual sphere and the metaphysical notion of world soul. It is not properly a mystic union, rather a methodological and philosophical acquirement. Actually, if we really and deeply understand how reality is, how the universal substance has been structured and the formal principles joins the matters, we will be able to know the right role played by human beings as an integral part of a whole and endless nature. This is due, as we showed, to the substantial identity of personal soul and world soul, just like a sort of natural averroism, which has no theological outcomes, rather it completely restricts human condition to its physical horizon, knowledge and thought included. Thus, at the beginning of the second part of Sigillus Sigillorum, on considering the four guides of inner operation, id est love, art, magic and mathematics, Bruno states that art perfectly operates when it is connected with operating nature. In other words, and even more explicitly, in order to obtain a perfect and universal art, you must connect yourself to the world soul. You must operate as if connected to it, because full of rational principle due to its natural fecundity, and because it generates a world full of similar rational principle. And just like Plotino believes, this rational principle, as seeds, shape and form everything as if they were small worlds. And since this soul is everywhere, it is totally inside everything and in each single part of the world. Then, according to the condition of matter, you will be able to consider into each thing, the smallest it may be, the whole world and not only a simulacrum of the world. Therefore, we together with Anaxagora can effectively assert that all is in everything. Thus, the core of Bruno's theoretical consideration is not the union between human and nature. Rather, he suggests we should investigate the connection between formal and material principle within nature in order to understand that we already are connected to nature. In fact, on recalling Plotinus, he says the world soul fills the nature with rational principles, and these principles are the seeds by which Anima Mundi models all the single things. This actually is the de la causa ontology. It is, Bruno is referring to the universal intellect, the faculty and the active power of the world soul. Let me now to eventually sum up my conclusions. Bruno consciously misunderstands Lull's combinatory. He manipulates and falsifies it in order to make it more effective in terms of quantity and quality of combination. He totally refuses Lull's theoretical framework. Bruno takes from Lull's art the raw computational and ordering power of figure, such as trees, scale, charts, and wheels. He applies them to his peculiar idea of dialectic, and furthermore to his mnemonic art. Indeed, he manages words, arguments, images, and places as if they were neutral objects within a net of open semantic relationships. Bruno forces a traditional and well-known technique within his own ideological framework. Why did he do it? I have tried to offer two answers. Firstly, he knew that Lull's art was a common language among non-Alagnid scholars, especially those who were refusing Aristotelian scholasticism, looking toward Ficinian Neoplatonism. So the first reason is the ideological affinity. The second reason is wholly theoretical. Bruno developed a new and radical philosophical perspective. Universal and infinite nature is the only existing being, while all other beings are part of it. They are not substances, rather they are accidents of the only substance. Nature has an endless body, the matter, and an omnipervasive soul, the form. This one is just like the Aristotelian personal soul. It makes nature live, since everything is non-stop changing. It makes nature feel, because everything is connecting to everything. It makes nature think, as it generates everything through infinite single acts of production. Obviously, this power is not anthropomorphic. Rather, it is an unique and universal principle common to every operating actor, human beings included. Therefore, this peculiar philosophical perspective needs a peculiar theoretical structure, which expands itself on every cultural aspect. Thus, from the logic and the theory of knowledge to rhetoric and dialectic, passing through mathematics, mnemonics, even magic art, they all have to be framed within this universal theory. Consequently, we may say that Bruno found in Lull's derived combinatory a kind of primary language for managing this theoretical hegemony, because of its specific combinatorial versatility and its dialectical neutrality. In conclusion, he uses it as a kind of computational code for a universal system that was no more medieval, not modern yet.